Back When is sponsored by Siwi, the National Trust's photo printing partner. Every image captures a story. Siwi's support means the National Trust can protect our nation's memories by caring for and sharing our vast collection of historic photographs. Through our work together, we're uncovering precious and previously unseen images for everyone to enjoy. Discover our work snapshotting 200 years of history. Search online for Siwi, that's C-E-W-E, and the National Trust.
These are grave markers. They're small stones and they've got a rough cross sort of gouged into them. So these were found in some of the fields around the village. The plague dead were not buried in the churchyard. They were buried informally in gardens and fields and so on, wherever the sort of bereaved families could actually get to. They're such a symbol of that hurried, hasty, having to just make do with the best of what you've got.
Sometimes appearances are deceptive, and a place that looks beautiful can mask dark happenings in its past. The location for this story is idyllic, but what happened here over 350 years ago is anything but. It's a picturesque village with quaint stone houses, a church, tea rooms, nestled in Derbyshire's Peak District National Park. But its chocolate box appearance is a far cry from the suffering and death that once happened here and the terrible choice that its residents made for the sake of others. Welcome to Eam, the Plague Village. Have you ever imagined being a fly on the wall of history? Join me for an inside view of the stories of people, places, and moments that made us. I'm historian Helen Antrobus. Lean in for a tale from time back when. Coming from not too far from Eam, I've heard a little of its story. A plague outbreak that took hold here and villages that isolated themselves to keep the disease from spreading to surrounding villages. It sounds familiar, but this was September 1665 to November 1666. When the coronavirus took hold and lockdowns were imposed, going through such a similar experience made me want to learn more. So I've come to meet Owen Roberts, curator at Eam Museum. Hello, you must be Owen.
Hello.
Now, we're not in the village, as I expected us to be. We're instead about a mile away, on the eastern edge, in the middle of a field. And my word, the Peak District is showing off for us today. The sky barely has a cloud in it. The sun is beaming down on us. We're in the middle of a lush green field surrounded by horses. But there's something really intriguing in the middle. We're standing next to an enclosed wall of seven graves. Can you tell me a bit more about it?
Yeah, these are the Riley Graves, and they're called that because of the farm, Top Riley, which is adjacent. They are the graves of the Hancock family, and the first member of that family died from the plague on the 3rd of August 1666. But by the time a week had passed, on the 10th of August, Elizabeth Hancock, the mother of the family, had buried her husband and six children.
We're stepping through the wall now into the gravesite, and I can see all the names of Elizabeth's family. John, Elizabeth, Alice. And there's a name here, I mean, it's not very common. Honour, O-N-E-R. And these stones, even though they are worn with time and there's lichen on some of them, they seem really well kept and in great shape. A lot of care must have gone into this burial.
It's quite likely that Elizabeth, the mother of the family, had to bury all her family members herself, as it was during the plague outbreak.
It's thought the gravestones were added later by the family's descendants, keen to remember their relatives who succumbed to the plague. Thankfully, Elizabeth survived.
She actually moved away from Eam after the plague to Sheffield, we think, where her oldest son, who had moved away some years previously, to live. So we understand that that's where she went afterwards. But her loss, losing all those children and her husband, was quite typical of what could happen in plague outbreaks in this period.
So really, there's more to this story. Whole families were decimated. And what I would really like to understand is how a plague that was rife in London made it all the way up here to what really is a small, enclosed community.
Well, let's go into the centre of Eme and I'll tell you a bit more about it.
We make our way down the hill and into the heart of the village, stopping outside a stone cottage with a well-kept garden. The first plague victim, George Vickers, lived and died here.
George Vickers was a tailor's assistant living with his employers, Alexander and Mary Hadfield. In September 1665, a box of tailor's materials was delivered to this house from London. These were damp, so George Vickers laid them out in front of the fire to dry. George became ill not long after this, and it's thought that the material was contaminated with plague. And within 5 or 6 days of the appearance of those first symptoms, he had died.
The Great Plague was rife in London when George Vickers received his box of materials from the capital. It was caused by bacteria transmitted to humans by the bites of fleas or lice, which were carried by rats. The city was infested with rodents. They were attracted by streets filled with rubbish and waste, especially in the poorest areas. Well, Owen, can you tell me what are the symptoms of the plague?
Yes, well, it's called the bubonic plague because it causes these great lumps in the skin when sores, which are called buboes. So it's actually an infection in the lymph nodes, and it can develop into pneumonic plague. So it can affect the lungs, and once it goes into the lungs, that means the disease can spread even more easily through coughs and sneezes. So you don't necessarily need fleas or lice to help in that situation. It's very infectious.
So poor George Vickers, he becomes the first victim of the plague here. How quickly does it spread?
Well, there were 6 deaths in 3 weeks in other households, which from other research we think were neighbouring houses.
By the end of October 1665 in Eme, 29 people had died, and by April 1666... the death count had reached 73. With the mounting number of deaths, it's likely community leaders were considering their options for containing the plague. But during the winter months, a lockdown wasn't imposed.
The infections from the plague actually slowed down during the winter, which is a pattern that you find in all plague outbreaks of this period. So we don't think that any major public measures were introduced at that point. By June, when the weather became warmer, the number of people becoming infected and dying started to increase quite rapidly. So we think at that point, special measures were taken. And we know that the community's religious leaders played an important part in this. And so if we go to the church now, we'll can tell you a bit more.
Let's go. The parish church of St. Lawrence is a short distance from George Vickers' cottage. It's a medieval church surrounded by a graveyard and is built in stone with a tower and a stained glass window.
This particular window that you can see is a memorial to what happened in Eme during the plague. And you'll see that in there are the figures of William Mompesson, who was rector of Eme during the plague, and his predecessor, Thomas Stanley. William was quite new to the village when the plague arrived. He was quite a young man. He was only about 27. And he had a wife, Catherine, and two young children, George and Elizabeth. He'd only arrived in 1664, the year before the plague came. His predecessor, Thomas Stanley, was still around in the village at the time. And the earliest accounts that we've got of the plague indicate that both these men played a key role in supporting the community and making whatever arrangements were made to help prevent the spread of the disease.
So the clergy took control. Would they get it right?
We do have some letters that have survived from William Mompesson. We've got in the museum one of his letters which refers to pest houses being set up, some sort of temporary accommodation for the sick and the dying. We know that the plague dead were not buried in the churchyard in 1666. There's lots of grave sites dotted around the village. There were other sort of accounts that gain a lot of details about a village quarantine, some kind of closure in the village. The church was closed off during the plague, that services were held outdoors, nobody was allowed in or out of the village.
That is a great ask to make of a community, and it seems like a great responsibility. Did everyone agree to the quarantine?
Well, there's certainly a strong tradition that the quarantine was agreed by the whole village, and it's certainly the case that the plague didn't spread outside Eam. But the exact details of the closure are quite hard to find in the earliest records. There is some folklore about some of the wealthier members of the community leaving. Those stories exist as well as the story of the entire village agreeing to observe the quarantine.
William Mompesson, the rector of Eam, stayed in the village throughout the plague. But what about his wife Catherine and their children?
His two young children were sent to relatives in Yorkshire. We know that he stayed from his letters and from the subsequent records, and that Catherine also stayed. And Catherine was one of the plague victims and died in August 1666. She's buried here in the churchyard. There is a tomb and you can still see it now.
Oh, it's a beautiful tomb, and it's incredible to see the Latin carvings on the top. It does stand out from the rest of the graves in the graveyard somehow. It must have been hard for William to see this at his place of work every day, a sacrifice, I suppose, that he made to the quarantine.
Well, yes, and he talks about the death of his wife in his letters. The letters that have survived include a letter that he wrote to his children about the death of their mother. And it's very moving to read that account, where he obviously celebrates her virtue and what he does describe as the sort of sacrifice that she made.
It just shows that no one was safe from this tragedy and from the plague. So the Eam quarantine, just like our own lockdowns during COVID, isn't straightforward.
Absolutely. I think our experiences of lockdown help us appreciate the complexity of these sorts of community experiences. We all have different perspectives. We all remember different things. It helps us understand that the plague in Eam was probably something like that too.
In Eam, under lockdown, despite the terrifying situation, people had to adapt and find a way to continue their everyday lives. So tell me, Owen, the village is closed off. How did those who managed to avoid contracting the plague feed themselves, especially if they can't leave the village to go to the market to buy food and supplies?
Well, to sort of talk about that a bit more, I think it would be helpful if we went and looked at what we call the boundary stone.
The boundary stone marks the boundary of the parish with the neighbouring village, but it's a bit of a walk away from the church. There is a replica in the museum just a short distance away. Eam Museum is a treasure trove of objects and information that reveal what it was like for people living through the extraordinary and scary time of the plague. So Owen and I head there and take a look.
It looks like a boulder, six hollows on the top. The only way I can describe them is almost like the top of a bowling ball. What on earth were these for?
We think it's where supplies were left during the time of the village closure. And food would have been left here, and in return the villagers would have left money, and that's where the holes come in. The money, the coins, would have been placed in those holes soaked with vinegar, so the holes would have had vinegar in them and the coins inside the vinegar.
Oh my goodness. So I'm thinking now to a more recent experience we've all been through and probably still remember. The vinegar's like a disinfectant, so what we would know as hand sanitizer in a way.
Well, yes, it is, really. I mean, because the antiseptic effects of vinegar were known, it was thought that that vinegar would cleanse the coins.
So, Owen, is it fair to say that they thought you could catch the plague by handling the same things.
Yes, that's right. They did think that. And we have in the letter from Mompesson that we have on display, there is a reference at the very beginning to the letter having been transcribed by somebody else, because William, as he writes, doesn't want to affright his uncle, who he's writing to, by a letter in my own hands.
It's great to see the displays in the museum, the boundary stone or historical hand sanitizer, and hear of other original relics like William Mompesson's letters. There were other accounts about what happened in Ean too, but these came many years after the last plague death.
The first accounts appeared in the very early 1700s, so a good 40 or so years after the plague. And then subsequent accounts towards the end of the 1700s start to develop, all acquiring a bit more detail. And eventually, by the time we get into the Victorian era, where William Wood, who was a local historian, the chronicler of Eam, published an extremely influential book called The History and Antiquities of Eam. And in there, you'll find all the details that people have often heard of about the Eam plague, which gives us an awful lot of detail, but a lot of it is indeed folklore, and we can't necessarily find some of those details in the earliest records that have survived.
Now, let's talk about the Victorians, Owen, because we know the Victorians loved a dramatic tale. Is that what's happened here? Is there a lot of embellishments?
Wood often likes to imagine scenes that happened, things that were said, as if we know that they definitely were said. But obviously we have no record of what those conversations actually were. But that, imagining that scene, is quite popular among 19th century writers. And then it's reported as if they were actually there.
Owen, please, can you tell me one of Wood's tales from the time of the plague?
There is a famous romance, and it's about Emmett Siddall and Roland Tor. The Siddall family did exist, and the story goes that Roland Tor lived in a neighbouring village and that they were engaged, and during the time the village was closed off, they would meet halfway in a secret place. They agree to meet sort of every day, but then one day, Emmett doesn't arrive. So Roland realises something must have happened, and when the village is opened up again after the plague, he runs into the village, sure enough to find the news that, yes, Emmett had died.
Oh, and call me a romantic, but I really hope that story's true. It's really wonderful.
I'll put Victorian melodrama aside for now. And moving back into reality, Owen takes me to see a rare surviving artefact, an original 350-year-old letter from the hand of our protagonist, Reverend William Mompesson, as he describes what it's like to live surrounded by the plague.
The first thing that strikes me is, I mean, the condition, considering how old it is fantastic. And just looking at what he's written here to his uncle, my ears never heard such doleful lamentations, my nose never felt such horrid smells, and my eyes never beheld such ghastly spectacles. This letter really strikes me as a remarkable survival because it does speak to the fear and the terror of what was happening here in Eam, but also to the very human reaction and approach to survival. It really is phenomenal to see.
We do have an extract of a second letter, which was sent at a time when Mompesson himself thought he had actually contracted the plague and was about to die.
Now, this letter, Owen, your heart really breaks for William, I think, in this, because he's talking about his fears of death and dying and succumbing to the plague to his patron and asking for prayers for his fatherless children, which so many of his parishioners must have done before him. And there's this fantastic extract where he writes, "And with tears, I beg that when you are praying for fatherless children, that then you would remember my two pretty babes." He must have been really convinced of his own mortality here.
He did, and bear in mind, it's the 1st of September 1666, so it's barely a week after Catherine's death. And he's thinking he too may soon die. And he's concerned about the children. He wants to make sure that should anything happen to him, those two children, George and Elizabeth, wouldn't be forgotten.
So William's letters have survived. But what happened to him? Did he stay in Eme after the plague?
He did stay in Eme for a few more years, but not that long after, just about 3 or 4 years or so, he moved to a different parish. It was in Nottinghamshire, northern Nottinghamshire, where he did actually marry again and had several more children.
On the 1st of November 1666, the Eme plague came to an end with the death of Abraham Morton.
He was a young man in his 20s. And there were other members of his family who had also died. There were 18 Mortons in our list of plague dead.
How many people died in total in Eme?
Well, 260 people died. The population of Eme at the time was about 800. So something like a third to a quarter of the village all died.
For those who survived, some were able to rebuild their lives.
We find in the parish registers after the plague a number of pragmatic marriages of women who've lost husbands, men who've lost their wives, and who are, you know, joining forces and rebuilding families. There are actually lots of people still living in the area who are descendants of people who survived the plague. And we do also get people who live much further afield who've traced their family history to Eme plague families.
It's really remarkable to hear about that hope to end the story on, because we've heard so much about the suffering during the outbreak of the plague in Eme, but we've also heard about how the villagers showed so much courage and resilience. And even though we're looking back hundreds of years, it doesn't feel like we have to reach that far back to understand that. Our own actions and experiences through the pandemics and lockdown feel so similar to the experiences of the families here.
Yes, I think that, you know, since we've all been through COVID and everything that that brought, it does help us to understand these momentous events, really, in our sort of shared human experience. And in Eme today, what happened in the plague is commemorated still on Plague Sunday, which is the last Sunday in August. There is a procession from the church to Cucklett Delph, which is the outdoor spot where we think services were held during the time of the quarantine. Flowers are still placed on that day on the tomb of Catherine Mompesson as a symbol of, sort of all those who died.
Once upon a time, this might have felt like ancient history, but hearing the story of Eme, it's impossible not to feel so connected to this community, despite the centuries between us. We've all been through the hardship and suffering of a pandemic and a lockdown. But as a country, we've come out of the other side with glimmers of hope, and I think an appreciation of community and togetherness. Thanks for listening to this episode of Back When. If you've enjoyed it, make sure you follow, rate and review us on your favourite podcast app. And if you fancy visiting Eme yourself, go to eme-museum.org.uk for more information. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another story. See you next time. This podcast is sponsored by Siwi, Europe's leading photo printing company. Every image you capture tells a story. Discover ideas for curating and creating your special memories and unique gifts for loved ones. From high-quality, personalised photo books to wall art made from your favourite photos. Head to Siwi, that's cewe.co.uk, and start creating your story.